You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
And we're live on air. My name is Allison. I am a CITR FM 101.9 in Vancouver. I am a community member on All Access Pass and the Accessibility Committee. And I'm joined with DP in studio.
Hi.
And on the phone right now, we have Christina Sheldon.
Hi, Christina.
So it's so exciting to have you here. And it's really exciting. It's really good. Do you want to start with the first question, DP?
Sure. So can you introduce yourself and your music?
Nice. Do you remember the first time? Oh, there we go. Can you hear us better now?
I can hear you clearly.
Perfect. So do you remember the first time you wrote a song and what that was like?
Yeah. So I guess I kind of, even as a little girl, was sort of writing music, sort of imitating writing music, but the first time I'd say I wrote a real song was in high school. I was actually listening to Michelle Branch's Goodbye to You, and I don't know, I guess I just really identified with her because this young brunette woman was writing music and singing, and I was like, hey, why am I not writing? Why am I not doing this? So I kind of sat down and I was kind of, I learned enough guitar, like I was learning covers, but I basically learned enough of the covers to start writing my own music. And then just used those chords and wrote my own song. And yeah, it just kind of opened up the whole world for me because I've always loved singing, but then being able to songwrite too is just, it's a different thing. It's a different beast. It's a way to communicate how you're feeling on the deepest level. And that really resonates with me because I'm a really emotive person. So it works for me, yeah.
Nice. Do you want to do the next question, DP?
So how did you end up joining the VAMPS board? Like you're on a board member at VAMPS. How did you end up joining?
Yeah, so Vancouver Adapting Music Society, VAMS, is, I think you've already spoke about this when you were talking with Greg Levine earlier, I was listening, but it's this amazing society that helps people reconnect with music after a disability and basically learn that even though you might not do music the way you used to, it's still 100% possible despite your physical level of ability to still create and produce music on even on a professional level. So at first I joined them just as a member. I went through GF Strong Rehabilitation Center after my accident, and they do have a studio in there, and I kind of would pass by it every time I went to physio and kind of peered in. And I was afraid at first because when I first broke my neck, I honestly thought that my career in music was over entirely, and my ability to play guitar was gone, and I had trouble getting out a sentence, never mind singing. So I was kind of crushed in that aspect, thinking my career in music is over, my musical ambitions are done, and I can't play guitar, which is what I used to do when I was feeling sad. I'd get out my feelings by playing guitar, and I couldn't do that anymore. And so as I was passing by VAMS, like I was curious about it, but I was also not ready to learn about the new way of doing music. But the the thing is, music, once it's in your heart, it's always there. And then I kind of put my name in with VAMS, and eventually they kind of hooked me up to work with Bobby Style, who's a musician and producer. And then they invited me to work on Music Saves videos, and I got to meet amazing people like The Odds, Greg Northey, Chin Jetty, all those names. I was having an amazing time, and as VAMS showed to me, opened up the world to me that music is still possible after injury. And so it was just through basically just working with them for so long that eventually Dave Symington asked me if I would like to become a board member. And I just shot up my hand and said, yes, of course, because if there's any way I can help other people experience what I experienced, reconnect with music, or for people who aren't already currently musical to learn how to connect with music and what that does for your soul on such a level, despite your physical abilities, I was like, I'm all for it. I am down for this. I would love to be a part of that. So long story short, Dave Symington asked me.
Nice. So how have your Indigenous and disabled identities informed your practice?
I am Dene, Northwest Territories. I got my blood through my mother, but I was raised by my white father. So to be perfectly honest, I don't have a lot of my Native identity known to me very well, and neither does my mother, actually, because she was pulled out of her Native community heritage to avoid getting scooped back in the 60s. So I am a whitewashed Native, and I was always kind of ashamed of that. But recently, I've had the fortunate, I've been kind of reaching out slowly, trying to stick up my tendrils, like, I'd love to get to know my heritage. I want to get to know this more. I hate that I don't know, but I'm embarrassed. And I've been introduced to, Rob Thompson, who runs Full Circle, and he's just like, and him and Krista Couture, actually, I worked with her 2 years ago, I guess now, for the International Women's Day performance at the Kulch through Wingspan Disability. And she was the first to say, that's actually a completely normal experience. That's a very common narrative, that Natives are feeling whitewashed. That's the whole part of colonialism. And then Rob Thompson, confirmed that and said that again. So basically where I'm at with it coming to inform my practice is that it hasn't that much insofar as I'm whitewashed. But then again, that's also part of the story. Does that make sense? Like it's involved in my history and therefore is a part of my music by it being existence, but it's not as forefront as it could be and as it's actually going to probably be going forward as I reach out further and meet more people of Indigenous background and step into that, community and hopefully reconnect with my heritage on a level that I've been wanting to do for a long time, but just haven't really had the opportunity to. Native speaking, it's kind of complex, and hopefully going forward will be better. but it was nice to know. It was very heartwarming, I guess, to know that I'm not alone in feeling whitewashed and feeling like I'm disconnected from my heritage, and that's actually quite normal. And it sounds like I'm going to be accepted as I step into this community, but there's a lot of opportunities coming up even this year that I might be able to get involved in the Native culture. So I'm very excited about that. And I hope that it inspires my music further. I'm sure it will. How can it not, right? awesome. I think you also asked about my disability, and some people with disabilities write a lot about their disability and their experience. And I don't know why, but I haven't. Like, I keep thinking I'm going to, but for some reason, I'm totally that emotional ballad love girl. Like, romance and love seem to be the themes on my plate. Although more recently, I feel as I'm growing older, I'm getting slightly more political. So I know that narrative is kind of taking an influence in. And in that respect, I think actually my disability is going to influence it, just because I can't help but speak about the things that affect me. And obviously, accessibility in the community and the way people treat people and all these kind of ideas are going to influence my future music.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope that makes sense. I don't know if I'm rambling.
Yeah.
I'm in a lot of pain, which is why I'm on the phone. And I really appreciate you guys being flexible and allowing me to talk on the phone rather than come in studio. This is sort of life with a disability. Yay.
Okay, so my next question is, what are your thoughts on people with disabilities showcasing their talent in music?
I'm sorry, what are my thoughts on people with disabilities?
What your thoughts are on people with disabilities showing their talents in music. Like, there's so many disabled artists out there. And you see on YouTube a lot of their music. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, yay. I mean, that's fantastic. Anyone who's got the passion and the ability and the desire and the determination to create music should, because it's such a connecting thing between people. It's a communicative device that sort of transcends regular communication. You can say things through music that you can't necessarily say or can't easily say in conversation. And it tends to connect on a more emotional level, on a resonance that it sort of sets you up to accept the message a little bit better, because it's tapping into your emotions while it's speaking to you. So I love hearing anyone of any ability creating music and putting their experiences out there, allowing even more people to go, good grief, thank goodness I'm not alone. And sort of, just knowing that, again, that even if you're doing it slightly different than an able-bodied person or than you used to, if you're a person with acquired disability, it's still possible, and you should still do it, even on a professional level, if that's what you want.
Right.
Yeah.
It's nice.
It's incredible. So much talent.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really is. And I mean, to be honest, that sort of segues me into something that's bothering me and that I'm hoping going forward will be better, is accessibility in music and in theater and in the arts. Is a bit of an issue, because traditionally, never mind getting into a performance space, oftentimes we think of stairs and accessible washrooms and whether or not they're good enough. So even just getting into an art space is challenging. But then the stages are obviously an issue for people with mobile disabilities. And so there's, a limited number of venues where people with disabilities or physical limitations can even perform. And I was lucky enough to be asked to be a juror for the City of Vancouver for their arts grants. And what I loved was how open everyone was and how committed everyone was to inclusivity. People of color, I think, I always forget the acronym, BIPOC, and LGBTQ and all that sort of thing. And they were willing to admit that they didn't really know much about the disability aspect of it, which I guess is the reason why they invited me to join. And it was wonderful when I spoke about these things and about the limited access and venue. Their eyes just lit up in this sort of, oh, right, moment. Like, it didn't even occur to me that that could be an issue, because the sad fact is, just the reality is that if you're not faced with it on a daily day-to-day basis, it doesn't really occur to you that that step is a barrier to somebody. And so it was neat to see their eyes light up and even know that these, because it's community members in there, were probably going to go forward in their own practices and their own productions and think about that and go, can people with mobile disabilities get in this place? Can I even employ disabled actors or singers or musicians or artists to get on the stage? And what can I do to make it better? So Sorry. Kind of a little rant there because it's important to me. And one thing that I've noticed, because my band, or well, the boys that I play with, two of them are in wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. And we're always like, well, where can we play? And we're always like, I don't really know. There's not really any place to play because we can't get on stage. Like, I'd love to perform at the Railway. That ain't ever going to happen.
No, well,
at least with my band. I mean, I can walk upstairs, so it's trouble for me, but I can make it. But yeah, it's just not an accessible venue. Sorry, I forget what your original question was.
No, it's okay.
It's all good. How do you rate your music? And is there a special place you go to or a special technique to write your songs?
How do I rate my music?
Right.
Oh, right. Like, oh, how do I? Okay. I'm definitely one of those writers who writes through the muse, where I tend to, in a fit of emotion, just pour out a song in the moment. And I love writing that because it feels so authentic and so real and raw. But what I'm actually trying to do and I'm currently practicing is to write even when the muse isn't talking, because I have so much respect for songwriters who can do that, who can just sit down and write, you know, emotionally touching songs, even if they're not necessarily specifically feeling that in the moment. And I think that's a true songwriter. So that's my plan, is to keep practicing songwriting and maybe even write songs that aren't personal to me, to imagine somebody else's experience and then write a song like that. I had a lot of fun just recently. Nimbus did the Canadian Songwriter Challenge, and I thought that it was like a competition, but it's actually just a group of singer-songwriters or musicians and songwriters getting together, and they're challenged to get into a group and just write a song out of thin air within a weekend, and then record a demo of it. And it was so much fun because I did exactly that. I just worked with these incredible people, and we developed this cool song within a few hours. It kind of just fell out of us as well. We worked well together. And it had nothing to do with me. It was nothing personal, but it was a lot of fun. So for me, anyway, when I write, I tend to write through the muse, but I am practicing on songwriting and just writing through the dark, even when the muse isn't sort of speaking to me. I'm sorry, the second part of the question was?
Is there a special place you go to or a special technique you use to write your songs?
Not really, no. I mean, I have a space set up in my home where I have my piano and I have my computer, and I'm trying to learn how to produce my own music just for fun. That tends to be, like, usually right at home, I would say, just because that's sort of my comfort zone. But I happily love going elsewhere and meeting new people and experiencing music and writing in other situations. Really, more or less, the ingredients for writing a song are a voice, an instrument, and a desire. And if you've got those three things, then you're good. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so growing up, which musician did you look up to, or who was your role model?
I used to be embarrassed to say, but now I think I'm going to proudly say Celine Dion. she was definitely my idol. Vocally, she is just, you know, a powerhouse. Like, so it was Celine Dion, Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, like these powerhouse voices that were, they sang and your jaw opened and you stopped whatever you were doing and you listened to them. You couldn't help yourself. So they were sort of my idols growing up, and probably why a lot of my music tends to have ballady moments where I'm just giving her.
Right.
So yeah, I would say those three, just incredible vocalists, which I really greatly admire what they can do.
Nice. Of all of the songs you wrote, which song do you really absolutely connect to?
It's kind of hard to ask a musician, because realistically, I mean, I suppose at the time I wrote them all would be the time I connected to them the most. So I would have to say Lost and Found, the song that I wrote most recently, is the song that I'm connecting to the most right now. I think the song that I love the most right now as well, because it isn't just about a guy or about love. It's, I mean, you can kind of, through the lyrics, you can kind of assume that it is, but it's really also just about trying to find yourself and your place in this world, and feeling like you're on unstable ground and trying to find your footing and just trying to find a place where you feel found and safe and looking for it. So I'd say that one right now, because kind of fighting through my disability, that's something I felt shaken up, like I've completely lost my footing, and it's about trying to find your way despite everything.
Nice.
Awesome. So our last question for you, what advice would you give for someone who is writing music and getting into the music industry?
My advice would be write, and write some more, and then write a little bit more. And do not be afraid to write something crappy. Like, just write, because every time you're writing something, you're developing new skills and new strengths.
Right.
And I think that's one of the harder parts as artists, is we want everything we produce to be gold. and that's putting way too much pressure on ourselves, because every single person, you know, every single star, you know, has written something crappy, and that's okay. It's all about part of the process. So don't be afraid to write something bad, just write anyway. And oftentimes you look back at some of the stuff you've done and you'd be like, wow, I was just in a mood, because that's great. Like, and also, network, communicate, right. Get involved with other people, talk, because it's sort of a cliche. I mean, I was told this as I was growing up, and I'm like, what do you mean talk to other people? What does that even mean? It means you'll get to know the people who are going to get you on the stage. And so the more people you talk to, the more times you perform and get out into the community, the more opportunities you give yourself.
Awesome.
Thank you, Christina. Thanks for taking the time chatting with us.
Thanks for allowing me to do this over the phone.
Yeah, no worries.
Accommodating my disability, obviously. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. We would love to have you in studio one day, so hopefully that happens soon.
Yeah. This is rare for me to be this bad, so I definitely hope that happens again, and it should.
Yeah, okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
So, we're talking to Allison Rodriguez of the Special Olympics. Who are you?
Allison Rodriguez. I'm in Special Olympics 28 years.
28 years. What is the Special Olympics?
The Special Olympics means I can meet friends, I can meet a lot of I get to travel places, I get to be inspired, and I get to show up on time for softball and floor hockey.
Yeah.
And it helps me do teamwork too.
Is it fun?
Yes, it's lots of fun.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
So what sports do you play for the Special Olympics?
I play softball, I do floor hockey, I used to do weight training, running club, field hockey, track and field, soccer, and 5-10 bowling, 10-10 bowling.
Why did you join the Special Olympics?
I heard through the leisure fair, and a lot of volunteers were very nice, so I decided to join the Special Olympics, try some sports on, and I really liked it a lot.
Nice. When did you join?
28. I have been an athlete for 28 years. I joined the Special Olympics in 1991.
Nice. What was your experience going to the Nationals in softball?
Softball, I would say getting a medal.
Getting a medal?
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you win national games for softball?
No, floor hockey.
Floor hockey.
I've got a gold medal in floor hockey and corner book, where I work and focus and confident and hold the puck in the middle. And other teams said, we're going to win the gold medal. But we came up with the gold medal, and they're with a lower down level team. So that's why I'm proud to wear this medal. It's a Newfoundland dog on it. That's a proud moment for me there.
Nice. Nice. And now you get to go to Worlds?
Nope, we didn't get to go to Worlds. We stopped there.
You stopped there?
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, negative experiences with special?
I don't know, nothing, I guess. I used to like track a few, but not anymore. I can't do it anymore. Something I can't do, like something, my hand swells up.
Yeah.
And that's why I can't do it. My knees and my legs. My body's telling me what I need to do now.
Yeah.
Come back.
Why is the Special Olympics so important for you?
Because the special, it gives me the opportunity to sponsor Staples, and I go and say, share a dream, give it to me, and I sign paper and put it on the wall.
Nice.
I volunteer, and there will be a softball tournament too. We're gonna have players there and play all day and have fun, and wear Staples tournament shirts.
What does the Special Olympics mean for you?
It's teamwork. It means inspiring me. It means showing your time, commit to your sports, and don't miss a day out of it.
Yeah?
Don't miss a sports day out of it.
What's your favorite?
Commit it.
What's your favorite part
and
of
teamwork.
Special?
And teamwork. What about football purposes? I like field hockey. I like baseball. But I like for hockey because for my ice hockey, because I asked my mom, can I do ice hockey? But she said, no, it's too dangerous. So I decided, okay, I'll give for hockey a try. And I started really liking that one too, my first joint. And the first time I went to the first for hockey thing that was too easy, they said, you're ready for the next level. So I was really very happy. And I made and I also won a trophy in that one too.
Nice.
That was a higher level, and it's good to be there.
Yeah.
They're all welcoming there.
And you get
and
all
Coach
your...
Craig's there for a long time. Nice.
But tell
awesome.
Me...
We've volunteered a long time.
Yeah. Tell me about your medals.
My medals, I have one for Kamloops and floor hockey. And I won lots of speed skating medals, track and field medals, and five pin medals.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you hang them around your...
No, not all of them would be too heavy and weigh me down the planet. I wear only special ones, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you tell people about being in the special, though?
Not really. I guess if they want to know, they come up to the leisure fair, and that's how they find out things, special Olympics.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where have you been with the Special Olympics?
Clarebrook, Kamloops. All over the world. I can't remember all places. Canada. All places Canada.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's your favorite spot? Where
my
was...
My favorite spot was Creek Corner, but
yeah?
They made us feel really welcome where they wear the scarves. And they give them medals out, and they have really nice uniforms.
Nice.
They coach a really nice alley, and all of them were there. Nice girl coaches.
Yeah?
That's my favorite memory. Corner, but...
Yeah?
Why?
So, how has the Special Olympics changed since you started?
Better, it takes me to be a better person. My teammate, passing the puck, hitting the ball in a few, learning how to catch, helping teammates out when you can, and hopefully go to the tournament on June 1st and 2nd.
Nice.
Yeah.
And because you're in Special Olo, you're... People see you as like an advocate for people with disabilities. Do you feel like it?
Yes, I do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why is it so important to be an advocate?
Because I can show what I can do and what inspires me, and I can share my things to other people and teach some of them.
Yeah?
Hi, thank you so much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM for Access Day 2019. That was an interview with athletes who were participating in the Special Olympics in Toronto over the summer. And just before that, there was an interview with Christina Sheldon, a disabled musician who was kind enough to speak with us on air today. Thank you so much, Christina. Also, thank you, Greg Labine, for performing earlier today. Also, I want to give like a shout out or whatever to all of the amazing campus and community stations who are also participating in Access Day. For those of you who don't know, Access Day is a full day of programming all around accessibility. And it is being broadcast between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. PST. on CITR with content contributed by stations from across Canada, including CRFC, CJLO, CJSR, CJSW, and of course CITR. So thank you so much to all of the stations and all of the just amazing content creators for producing this content and raising awareness and starting this conversation, because it's a conversation that is not had nearly enough. Thank you for my little interruption. Now we're going to play an interview with David Roach, who is a comedian out here in Vancouver. Again, thank you for tuning in to Access Day on CITR 101.9 FM.
Can you tell the listener about yourself?
I'm David Roach. I am 75 years old, chronologically, in spirit, much younger, and my health, my doctor says I'm 58. So I lied about being 75. I live on the Sunshine Coast of British Columbia. I've been an activist for 50 years in various ways, around the second wave of feminism, gay liberation, disability activism, single parents and child care activism, services for single parents. I am one of the co-founders of the child care switchboard and single parent resource center of San Francisco. We started out of cities and became a national model for organizations of that sort. My wife Marlena and I were two of the co-founders of the first massage therapy program in a hospital in the United States, and that too became a national model. And I'm a pioneer in disability arts. In my middle years, after I quit drinking, which was key, and found my true love, Marlena, I had love and sobriety, and I decided I wanted to get on stage, and I did. Within a couple of years, I quit my day job and became a solo performer, a keynote speaker, a storyteller. Here's what I do. I get on stage and people see me. I have a significant facial difference, a swollen, tangled veins on the left side of my face and neck, inside my mouth, my tongue, my throat, insulin, and I've had radiation therapy when I was 1 year old back in 1945 that caused the lower part of my face to stop growing, and I had surgeries, so I have had an unusual, unique face for a long time. You might say I was born with it. I never talked about it though until I got on stage. Well, you know, and I was a pioneer. And by pioneer, I mean being kind of first in the field. And another key thing about being a pioneer is that you don't know what you're doing. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a pioneer, right? So I was on stage, and I did not know I had a disability. I'm talking here about the social model of disability. People always perceive me as being disabled. So I am. That's just the way it is. Cheryl Marie Wade, one of the pioneers and the icons of disability arts and activism in the San Francisco Bay Area, called me up one day. I did not know who she was. And she said, "Did you know that you're disabled?" And I said, "What?" And she explained the social model of disability to me and invited me to a meeting of disability artists in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And there I was, and that's where I stayed. I've been a storyteller. I've been a funny. I'm always funny. Oh, I was telling you, I get up on stage. I'm seen as being disfigured, and people wonder, "Oh my God, he's not going to be funny, I don't think." But within about 10 minutes, I have transformed from being someone who's noticeably, severely disfigured into someone who's incredibly attractive. And that ability to transform myself, I do through humor and charm and love. And when people see that, they love it because everybody wants that for themselves. And one of the things I've learned from being on stage and having a facial difference is that everybody feels disfigured. And I feel like inside ourselves, we have a little place where guilt and fear and shame reside. And I, because of having my difficulty on the outside, I had to learn to find my beauty on the inside. Being on stage helped me to do that. So I see myself as beautiful. And so my face is a gift. And there's a second gift. I now have the ability to see the beauty of other people. And that came after learning to love myself. So I live in a world of beautiful people. And so that makes me a fairly happy person. Although I also have a dark side, and I married Marlena, who's fairly consistently joyful and happy, so I don't have to be. I can be a joy parasite. So that's me, a joy parasite. Right now I'm in a residency for artists with disabilities in Vancouver schools, and I'm loving that, and I get to work with kids. And I was just at the Vancouver premiere of a feature film that I'm in. And I'm getting to do a benefit for Kickstart, Disability Arts and Culture, where I have been part of Kickstart for the entire life of Kickstart, minus 1 year, but really early on. I was on the president of the board for several years. That was difficult, but, you know, it's turned out great, and Kickstart has really helped so many artists and performers with disabilities find their voice and take their place on stage, in galleries, you know, in the studio, all kinds of places.
Why should we care about disability advocacy?
I think the big reason for that is the effect on the advocates themselves. I should say I am in disability arts, so I'm not out there like people like testifying before the provincial legislature or Vancouver City Council or anything like that. Like I'm working in theaters and venues and hotel conference rooms and stuff like that. But to roll it back to Kickstart Disability Arts and Culture, I go back to the first Disability Arts Festival in Vancouver. That was at the Roundhouse. God, I think that was in 2000. I know people whose careers started at that festival. And that is a lot of the reason why that festival and why Kickstart continues to be an important force for the arts in Vancouver. So that's a form of disability advocacy that I am very familiar with, and I've seen the effects of. And I know the, for example, Victoria Maxwell, who's bipolar, who has a one-woman show. It started back then at that festival. Jane Sanders, who did Skydive, founded the Real Wheels Theatre Company in Vancouver. He started at that festival, too. And I already had a career by that time, but I certainly wasn't encouraged by that. Now, I think that carries over the people who are advocates, say, in the political field. When you get on stage and you perform, you're knowing who you are, you're telling your story, you're claiming your truth. The same thing happens when you testify and do political advocacy. The fact that you're doing that strengthens you. So that right there is, to me, sufficient argument for disability advocacy. Now, I also am friends with Al Etnansky, and he and Vicky Kanak, his spouse, founded Planned Lifetime Advocacy Network, which is now worldwide and also instrumental in starting the RDST, Retirement Disability Savings Program. That changed Canada and is a model internationally also that benefits people with disabilities. So there's disability advocacy that paid off big time. So it runs from that personal empowerment thing to like something that can change government policies. Those are some of the arguments for disability advocacy.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Who are you?
My name is Galen Lee, and I'm a musician and a public speaker from Duluth, Minnesota. I play violin and write songs, and I do it with a live looping pedal. So I kind of play violin and then record what I play live, and then it layers it up. So it's kind of a fun tool to create a lot of layers of sound with just one instrument.
How did you get into music and playing the violin?
I got into music when I was in fifth grade. I mean, my family is very musical, so we were always around it. But in terms of stringed instruments, I heard an orchestra in fourth grade. They played at my school, and I really loved the way it sounded. So the next year, I decided to sign up for orchestra. And I was lucky that I had a teacher that was really creative and open-minded because I play up and down like a cello, so I don't have very long arms. I have a disability, so my arms and legs are bent, and so I couldn't play the violin the regular way, so I play it up and down like a cello in my wheelchair, and then I hold my bow like a bass player does. And so I've been playing that modified style since I was 10, and then, you know, I never stopped. I did classical for quite a while through high school, and then switched over to fiddle music in college and started writing my own songs and playing in bands after college.
Can you describe the type of music you play?
There's two different parts to my shows. The one part with the live looping pedal, I play a lot of traditional Celtic and American fiddle tunes that I kind of rework because of all the layers of sound. You can really alter the mood and make it sound kind of more symphonic or orchestral. So I kind of do my own takes on these traditional fiddle tunes. And then my original songs are a little bit more folk or indie songs that I write about things I think about, like relationships and the nature of life and stuff. So I guess probably folk is a good way to describe the original tunes.
What is your disability?
I have brittle bones disease, which is collagen disorder, so it's a genetic disability, and so my bones are just not as strong, and they broke before I was born. A lot of them did, including my arms and my legs, so that's why they're shorter. So I've used a wheelchair since I was 2 and a half. I got my first electric wheelchair, and, you know, it impacts your life, obviously, in a lot of ways, but then on the other hand, I've also had a really great family and good friends, and I've been able to adapt a lot of what I do. The reason I got into activism is because as an adult, you kind of start to notice the inequalities that exist for people with disabilities. And so that's become part of what I do on the road, is I intersperse speaking events about disability awareness and disability rights in with my concerts. So it's been a good way to kind of connect both parts of my identity.
You've been a disability activist before getting into music professionally. Can you tell us about how you got into disability activism?
Well, actually, the music came first. The activism came second. But I was a musician in my hometown, and I played a lot around. But then there was a conference being held in my hometown of Duluth, Minnesota, about health and human services. And I was talking with a friend who said, you know, she felt like through her master's degree in social work, they didn't really talk about disability very often. It wasn't covered in the way that she felt like it could be. And so she suggested I do a session at this conference. And I did. I prepared a like a 3-hour, it was pretty long, a 3-hour workshop about a lot of different disability awareness issues that I felt would be important to know if you were working with people with disabilities. And the reason I kept going after that first conference is because the feedback I got from people who work with disabilities every day was just like, they hadn't heard a lot of the things that I had said, or they had never thought of it that way. And I realized that we just don't have a lot of dialogue in our culture about disability issues, like, that's mainstream. So a lot of people in the disability community share a lot of the same ideas or talk about these issues, but they're not making it into the mainstream. Even people who work with people with disabilities aren't hearing the messages sometimes. And so I started thinking about ways that I could talk about it more often in a public way to kind of help shape the dialogue of our society. I'm not the only one doing that, obviously, but I think it really needs to happen as much as possible right now.
You did a TED Talks about disability at Yale University. How was that experience?
It was fun. I mean, it's kind of intimidating because you have to have it like pretty down pat, but it was a good experience. It was based on a paper that I wrote in college that had been kind of a transformative experience for me, and it was neat to be able to share those ideas in a little more accessible format for people. And it was a cool experience. I've actually done 2 TED Talks now, so I did another one a year later. So it's been a surprise. I never really expected to be doing stuff like that.
How do you blend both disability activism and accessibility in music?
Well, that's an interesting question because I think I'm figuring it out as I go. I mean, some part of me also wants to make sure that I just hold on to my identity as a musician first and foremost. I don't necessarily want to be known as the disabled musician or the activist musician because I play music because I like it, and I want it to be judged on the merits of if it's good or not any other identity. There are ways that it does intersect a few of my songs just because the way you write is you write about what you think about. A couple of my songs have pretty explicit disability themes, especially one on the last album called I Wait. It's about basically the disability rights movement in America and fighting for change and how it feels frustrating when the change isn't there yet. And then the other piece of accessibility that comes into my musical career is fighting for accessible venues, not just for the audience, which is important to me, really important to me, but also trying to make the arts more accessible for people with disabilities to get involved as performers. So don't play at venues that aren't accessible to the audience, obviously, although that's harder than it sounds. There's a lot of places that are not accessible that musicians are expected to play at, and I just can't in good conscience do that anymore. And then I don't want people to lift my wheelchair on stage anymore. I did that for many, many years, and I know a lot of artists do that, but I feel like it kind of gives the venue owners permission to not become accessible if I allow that to happen indefinitely. So I was noticing that if I allowed the venues to just lift my chair up rather than get a ramp or rent a ramp or build a ramp, that they saw that as being accommodating, and it kind of misses the point because it's much more tricky for people with disabilities to play if they can't get on the stage. And I'm small, so I can be lifted up, but not everybody's small and can be lifted easily. And so I decided one thing that I can do is if they won't build a ramp or rent a ramp, I'll just play on the floor in front of the stage, which feels a little bit second-class citizen, but it's making a point. It's very obvious to the audience then that they haven't done the work to get a ramp. So I don't really talk about it during my shows because I see my shows as things where people can go and kind of experience it for themselves and be entertained, and I don't want to make the dialogue all about disability. But just the mere act of seeing somebody performing on the floor and realizing that the reason that they're doing that is because there's not a ramp, I think sends a message to the venue for sure, but also kind of opens up the eyes of the audience. So that's where I'm at right now. And I don't talk about this stuff from the stage, really, because I really do believe the value of a performance is the creative part of it for me. But I think that those things are all going on behind the scenes, and probably people notice them when it happens. The Kickstart Disability Culture and Arts, they're a really neat group. I have a lot of respect for what they do, and I'm excited that they wanted to do a second concert I played last year for my first show in Vancouver with them. And they were just great. They understand all of this stuff. And so they work really hard to make sure that it's accessible to not just the audience, but to me too. It's really cool. I respect them a lot.
You won the 2016 NPR Tiny Desk Concert for your song, Someday We'll Linger in the Sun, which was selected over 6,000 submissions. What was that experience like?
That was very surreal. I just didn't expect that I would win. You know, you enter a contest like that having no, it just didn't feel like a possibility. But I did it just kind of for fun, and a couple of my fiddle students had encouraged me, because at the time I was teaching fiddle lessons in my hometown, and so I decided to give it a shot. And then, yeah, winning was very surreal, but I knew that it was going to change a lot for us, and it has. Our life is a lot different than it was when I won 3 years ago, but it's provided a ton of opportunities. And the people at NPR Music ended up being really nice, and it's cool to see them now occasionally when we happen to be in the same cities. Yeah, it was very surreal. I remember thinking, kind of taking your surroundings, because you're going to want to remember this moment, the phone call that they made to tell me I had won. I luckily remember it, because I remember thinking, kind of take in all the details of this phone call. And the funny part is you can't tell anyone. So I was allowed to tell my bandmates, who came out with me to do the last two songs on the Tiny Desk contest or concert, the final video that went out, the fourth song. And I was allowed to tell the lady who filmed it and my immediate family, but I wasn't allowed to talk about it in my community or with my friends, because they really didn't want it to leak before they announced it a week later. So the first week that I knew, I really couldn't talk about it. And it was really weird, because people would be at my shows and be asking, how is music going? And I just had to be like, fine, going well, even though I knew that in a week it was going to be much different than it was that day. So it was a fun week to just kind of have that secret.
Do you get any negative comments about your activism and or music?
I mean, I know they're out there. Like, you should never read Google or, like, you know, YouTube comments or whatever. Overall, people have been supportive, the ones that come to my shows. I mean, I suppose that's how it is, right? Like, people who go to your shows are there because they want to be there. I try not to take too much stock in either realm, because you really can't please everyone. Like, you know, I'll put out a new song and I'll notice somebody says, oh, I liked this other one better or whatever. And you just can't let that get you down, because it's just, there's, everybody has different opinions. And that's, you know, music, as much as we don't like to think that, it really is just like a preference or an opinion, what people resonate with and what they don't. And so I try not to let that get me too confused. And then as for activism, I don't know if I've heard any negative feedback. It does make it harder to find places to play and stuff, because I have pretty high standards for accessibility. And I'm sure that makes things a little trickier, but overall people understand why I'm doing it. So they're willing to work with me, or at least a lot of venues are, not every venue. A lot of spaces are open to learning and trying to do a good job, even if they hadn't been faced with it before.
Why should we care about disability activism?
Well, I think the biggest reason is, to me, disability is a form of diversity. In the same way that we try to support in our cultures, like, people of different backgrounds, of race or gender or ethnicity or anything like that, it's important to view, to me, disability is just another way of existing in the world that's not good or bad, but it's just there, and it's something that we kind of have a responsibility to recognize the human rights of people with disabilities. And so the other reason we should care is it's about 20% of the population. People with disabilities are all over the place. You can't see every disability. There's invisible disabilities in there, and there are people who develop them later in life, or if you live long enough. We don't necessarily use the term disability around people who are older, but honestly, that's what it is. If you get old, then you end up developing health issues. Suddenly, you're facing the same situations that the rest of the disability community faces their whole lives. And so just realizing that we're all connected and that disability can happen at any time. So you might be perfectly healthy now, and then a car accident or a stroke or whatever happens, and suddenly you are disabled. And it's important to remember that it's not, you don't want to just fight for it if it applies to you, that it, just recognizing that everybody has value and it's a human rights issue, and it could happen to you or someone you love at any time. And so just being aware of it and fighting for equal rights is really important, I think, for the whole of society, not just people who have disabilities right now.
What can we expect in the future out of your music and your disability activism?
Well, out of my music, I'm releasing a song later this fall that I recorded and mixed and mastered this winter. But I'm just got to write more because I released a full-length album. That's one of the reasons I'm coming back to Vancouver, is to bring that album out to Vancouver. So I released an album in September, so now I'm going to write a bunch of new songs and record them, so that'll be in the next year or two, probably, where a full album comes out. And then for my activism, or at least a different side of my creativity, is I really want to write a book about the experiences of touring that I've had, especially through the lens of a disabled artist, because I think touring has given me the chance to meet a lot of other activists as well, and just kind of expand my views. And it's really helped, like, to learn. I mean, I have one set of experiences, but disability is very diverse, so I've learned from other people, too, about what they face and stuff. And so I want to write about my experiences winning the Tiny Desk and traveling and then trying to fight for equality in the arts and all over the place. So I want to write that book in the next year or so. I just launched a Patreon in the end of March that's going to help hopefully build up some income so that I can take some time off to write, because it's pretty hard to do anything creative on the road, and we're on the road a lot right now, like like all the time, it feels like, so, which is great. But then I want to have some time to make some new stuff.
Thank you so much for talking with me.